We are joined on the line now by Tom Hartmann, progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host on the radio like us. Welcome, Tom, to KBOO.
Hey, Jenka. Thanks for having me.
And now you are the author of a number of hidden history books, the hidden history of the Supreme Court and a number of others, and now the hidden history of oligarchies in the United States. And I wonder if you could begin by just maybe defining oligarchy and how it's different from democracy.
Sure. Well, democracy is where governance, the decisions that guide a society, are made by the majority of the people. Oligarchy is where governance is, and the decisions that guide a country are made by a small group of very wealthy people. My last book was about monopoly, a hidden history of monopoly. I think we talked about it. And that's when you concentrate economic power in a society. Oligarchy is when you concentrate political power in a society. So they're kind of bookend books.
Right. And you, in your book, talk about the last 40 years, the consolidation of power in the oligarchs beginning in the Reagan administration. But in a way, hasn't the U.S. always kind of been a country run by oligarchs, beginning with the white, wealthy, slave-owning men that started the country?
Yes, absolutely. And it's gone in waves. It's gone in waves from peak oligarchy. We hit a couple of major peak oligarchy waves, one in the 1850s and 60s, which led to the Civil War. The second one, big one, was after the Industrial Revolution from the 1890 to 1930, which led to the Great Depression. And the third one in relatively modern history really started in a big way in 1980 with the Reagan Revolution. Prior to Reagan, in the period from 1940 to 1980, the middle class was actually growing faster. The wealth and income as a percentage for the middle class was growing faster than was the top 10% or even top 1%. Reagan, of course, reversed all that with his policies following basically what Warren Harding had done in 1920. And so between a Supreme Court decision, a couple of Supreme Court decisions in the 1970s that really brought Reagan to power and established this, and were followed up by Citizens of the United, and this 41-year now neoliberal experiment, we are really at peak oligarchy right now. Gillens and Page, a couple of researchers from Columbia University, did a study, a really good long-term study, and they found that prior to 1980, in the period from 1950 to 1980, when you looked at public opinion surveys on public policy versus legislation that got passed at both state and federal levels, what you found was that typically anything that had majority support in the bottom 90% of Americans became law. And the stuff that was supported by the top 10% of Americans, it could become law, but it wasn't quite as predictable as the bottom 90%. Post-Reagan, basically since 1988 or 89, the probability of legislation that's widely popular among the bottom 90% becoming law has been reduced to what they referred to as equivalent to random noise. In other words, there is no more democracy, essentially. What the people want is not what's getting made into law, but what the top, in particular the top 1%, want is made into law very, very often, well over 70% of the time. And so we're in not a full-blown oligarchy right now, but we're damn close to it.
And how does an oligarchy move into a state of tyranny? I know you give the example of Hungary and a lot of parallels there between the Trump administration and the oligarchy there.
Yeah, Viktor Orban's administration. Absolutely. The a lot of this comes out of this conservative impulse. In 1951, Russell Kirk wrote a book predicting that, keep in mind, back then the middle class was growing faster than the rich, predicting that if the middle class continued to get wealthier and wealthier, it would hit a point where society would break down, where young people would no longer listen to adults, to their parents, where women would no longer submit themselves to their husbands, where minorities would be producing chaos in the streets, et cetera. And everybody thought he was a crackpot, except William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater. But, you know, he published this book. And then the 60s happened, and the birth control pill was legalized in 61, and which produced the women's movement and in the workplace. The civil rights movement was very, very active. Martin Luther King active during that time. Students were saying, no, we're not going to go to the Vietnam War. They were burning draft cards. And other minorities, gay people, there was a gay rights movement. All these things were happening. And at that point, the conservatives looked around and said, holy cow, Russell Kirk was right. Society is breaking down. We've got to strip some of this wealth out of the middle class. And now they thought they were doing the best thing for society, right? The Buckleys and Goldwaters and Reagans of the time, to stabilize American society. The problem is they set about doing it. In just 12 years, Reagan and Bush destroyed about half the union jobs in America, started aggressively outsourcing our factories. There's just this major change. And now somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion of wealth has been taken out of the pockets of the middle class and put into the pockets of the top 1%, which was supposed to produce this 1950s-like stability, the June Cleaver world. But in fact, what it's produced is chaos. And out of that chaos come these opportunists, these fascist opportunists who say, well, we've got the solution. You just need more law and order. You just need more tough guy stuff. We just need to. And essentially, that's what happened in Hungary. That's what happened in Germany in the 1930s, coming out of the Great Depression and the Treaty of Versailles. In country after country after country, what you see is as the middle class gets shredded, it doesn't produce a return to stability. It flips a society into fascism. And that's the direction we're heading right now. And that's the direction, sadly, that the Republican Party seems committed to now that we see that Kevin McCarthy just went down to see Donald Trump and they're trying to purge the party of Liz Cheney, for God's sake. I'm very concerned that we're heading right straight toward full-blown fascism here in the United States.
Mm. And, of course, the 1950s, the stability there, well, and of course it was stability for certain races of people. There was certainly a lot of racism at the time, but it was built on the New Deal and the 90% tax rate of the time, not on the kind of oligarchic control that that you're talking about.
That's correct. Yeah, and in fact, tax policy was a major thing. We had a 90% top tax bracket, right up until Lyndon Johnson dropped it, I think in 67, and down to 74%. And then it was a 74% until the second year of the Reagan administration. When Reagan dropped it down to 25%, of course, that's when everything started to unravel.
And I just want to talk briefly about debt peonage. You talk about the reality of the 13th Amendment, in which slavery was abolished except for those in prison. And, we heard some about this system of debt peonage in Ferguson after Michael Brown was killed, and the way that municipality was funded on the debt of the very poor. And I wonder if you could talk. I was surprised to read in your book about Mississippi and restitution centers, which are essentially debtors' prisons. How deep does this go?
Oh, it goes all the way down. I mean, and it's now a major for-profit industry. The 13th Amendment did not end slavery in the United States. I know we all learned that in elementary school, but in fact, if you read the amendment, it says slavery shall be ended except for punishment for crime. And in other words, it is still legal in the United States to hold a person literally as a slave, to enslave them, to force them to work and produce goods. And we have companies all over America that are using prison labor, that is the euphemism. It's slavery, are using prison labor to make profits. And then, of course, just using human bodies to make profits. You've got these private prison companies, particularly the ones contracting with ICE that Donald Trump was so fond of. It's a horror show. It really, really is.
And a lot of people think, we kind of dodged a bullet in November by the election of Joe Biden. And yet 70 million, ostensibly, people voted for Donald Trump. I wonder if you could talk about how it is that so many people are willing to vote against their own interests. Are they just too propagandized to know what's true? Or they believe Trump's lies that he would tax the rich and, you know, pull back factories from foreign countries and replace Obamacare with a system that covered everyone? Is it the control of the media, as you talk about?
Yeah, that was Trump's main sales pitch, you know, was I am Bernie Sanders. And, you know, he said he was going to bring the factories back from the from China and Asia and Mexico, which Bernie and Sherrod Brown and a good chunk of the Democratic Party have been working on for years. You know, we have to kind of slap Bill Clinton upside the head for getting us in this situation. But he was just implementing policies that have been negotiated and treaties that have been negotiated by Reagan and Bush, you know, NAFTA and the GATT agreement that created the World Trade Organization. And, you know, so number one, Trump lied through his teeth saying that he was going to give everybody in the country health insurance and it would be less expensive and less complex than Obamacare. He said he was going to bring back our jobs and they would be good paying jobs and all that kind of thing. And it's just, as you point out, I mean, it's mind boggling that people were voting for a progressive agenda that Trump was presenting. It's why he was able to win the Republican primary, because Republican ideas are just so unpopular in general. And then he didn't follow through and, you know, essentially was blaming it on everybody else. And now, see, this is, as a society, we have been watching our society being gutted. 41 years of Reaganism has devastated. 10 years ago was the first time since 1951 that half of America was no longer in the middle class. We no longer even have, you can't even call it a middle class because it's not the median any longer. Half of America, more than half of America, 10 years ago, fell below the, you know, what was considered the threshold of middle class. We are a nation in poverty now as a result of 41 years of Reaganism. When people are impoverished, they do crazy things. They start looking for easy answers. They start listening to crazy conspiracy theories. I for years I did international relief work, and I did a lot of work in the Middle East and in Northwestern Africa. And you go into countries that are run by, that are basically oligarchies, or where the government is very unstable, and where there's, you know, widespread poverty, but not like, I'm not talking famine. I'm just, you know, like what we're experiencing in America right now, widespread homelessness, you know, food insecurity. Right now in America, 1 in 7 families, this was in the Washington Post, 1 in 7 families who are renters are not able to feed their children today in America. When you go into countries where the situation is like that, what you find is that news is mostly conspiracy theories. People don't believe the news. People don't believe the government. It looks to them like everything's falling apart. And so conspiracy theories come to consume the country and sometimes overthrow governments. And we're seeing that with, you know, these QAnon crazies right now.
And so people are susceptible to an oligarchic ruler because they are wanting stability?
That's correct. And safety. You know, they don't feel safe. I mean, the United States is one of the least safe of the developed countries. We're the only of the 34 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries, the 34 richest countries in the world. We are the only one that doesn't offer free health care or close to free health care to every one of its citizens as a right. We are the only one that doesn't offer free college or something close to free college. And in many of those countries, I mean, like in Denmark, they pay you $400 a month to go to college, we're the only one that right now out of the OECD countries, I think we're one of three actually, that are not making weekly payments to everybody in the country at a level of around a minimum of $500 a week. I mean, the entire rest of the developed world is taking care of their people. We are gutting our people. We have been doing this for 40 years. Part of the reason why Reagan did it was he thought it would, you know, return stability to America, that, you know, him and Lewis Powell and all these guys. But the other part of it was by gutting the unions, he was also demonetizing the Democratic Party. And, you know, which forced Clinton to create the DLC and start taking money from banks and insurance companies. So it's been a weird and twisted 40 years, but those of us who were yelling about it back then are looking around now going, yep, this is exactly, you know, and I just, for the book, it was not particularly difficult to document this arc.
Well, and in your book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, like Daniel Ellsberg writes, I learned something new on every page, something I should have known. You know, like, I was appalled that 500,000 people have to declare bankruptcy for medical debt in this country, when in a whole list of other countries you mentioned, zero people are claiming bankruptcy for medical debt. It's
right. We're the only OECD country where medical debt causes bankruptcy.
And a couple of days ago, you wrote that we're in an unacknowledged second Republican Great Depression. And you say only government can hold oligarchs in check. With so many politicians now either with allegiance to the oligarchs because of campaign contributions or being oligarchs themselves, how can we expect them to make the change necessary? Or I guess, how can we pressure them to make the change necessary?
Well, this is exactly, Jenka, why I think it's so important that that H.R. 1 and Senate Bill 1, this first piece of legislation, just like Nancy Pelosi got out of the House 2 years ago, is the first piece of legislation, is legislation that is going to force dark money to reveal itself. It's going to force the billionaires behind these various groups that are influencing politics to put their names on things. And it's going to limit the power and influence of money in politics. The thing that really turned us in this direction was the Buckley decision in 1976. Prior to 1976, it was basically illegal for a billionaire to own a politician. And in 76, the Supreme Court said, that's not corruption, that's not bribery, which is what we always used to call it. That's actually free speech. Money is the same thing as speech. And so if you want to give money to a politician and you're rich and the politician does you favors, that's free speech. And then 2 years later in the Bilotti decision, they extended that logic to corporations. And then in 2010 on Citizens United, they doubled down on it and expanded it. And that's what has been powering much. That created the Reagan Revolution. It created an avalanche of cash in 1979 and 80 that brought Reagan into power. And it has sustained the Republican Party, and to some extent the Democratic Party as well, ever since. And right now it's roiling the waters. And so if we want to get back to democracy and back out of this oligarchy that we are three quarters of the way into right now, the first thing we have to do is get control of money in politics.
And another thing that you are suggesting is in breaking the oligarchy is prosecuting Trump. Now, one of the headlines that kind of got overshadowed in the last few weeks of many, many headlines is the Supreme Court deciding against allowing Trump to be tried for violations of the Emoluments Clause, in which he abused his position to make personal profit. Now, how could Trump still be prosecuted under the Hatch Act? Is that a possibility?
I doubt the Hatch Act would be the one you'd want to use, because, you know, it's a relatively small crime, using government property for political purposes. There are a bunch of people in his administration who could be prosecuted, you know, Kellyanne Conway at the top of the list, and Ivanka Trump, you know, with Goya Beans and all this kind of stuff. But I think that sedition is what he needs to be prosecuted for, among other things. And it looks like, you know, New York is going to go after him for tax fraud and real estate fraud and bank fraud and all kinds of things. The guy's been a grifter his entire life. He's a serial liar and a psychopath, frankly. And those kind of people can be very dangerous. We're seeing that right now in real time.
And we're going to have to wrap it up. I know your time is valuable. I appreciate you taking the time with us. I just wanted to follow up with this book was written, of course, before the election and before the events of January 6th. And I wanted to get your comments on the Capitol insurrection, which in some ways is an extreme of your example of the normalization of outrageous behavior that leads to tyranny.
Yeah. The last 3 weeks have been very concerning. The Republican Party following January 6th had a choice. They could either repudiate treason and embrace, you know, going back to being a normal political party in a semi-functioning democracy, or they could fully embrace treason and become a full-blown fascist party, like Marine Le Pen's party in France, or I forget the name of the party in Sweden, or the new AfD party in Germany, or Viktor Orban's party, or Putin's party. And it sure looks in the last few days like they've decided to go in the latter direction, which I think is a very, very bad signal. I don't think people realize how dangerous that is. If the Republican Party goes fascist, it's entirely possible it can take the entire country with it.
And as an antidote, you do point out that humanity and human nature are inherently good. Democracy is hardwired into human behavior. And here's hoping we go in that direction.
Yeah, well, typically when countries go full fascist, it lasts for a generation and then people wake up. Usually the fascists are defeated. We saw this in Japan and Germany, Italy and Spain during World War II as a consequence of World War II. And you can see it over and over again throughout history. And we certainly have seen it in the United States with the rise of fascism in the South in the 1850s and 1860s. And we beat that back. So I'm still hopeful, but I'm very concerned.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again. We've been speaking with New York Times bestselling author Tom Hartmann, also a talk radio host. His newest book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. You can find it at your nearest independent bookseller. Thank you, Tom Hartmann, for joining us on KBOO today.
Thanks, Jenka. It's always great being here. I so appreciate your having me on your show.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.